Welcome to the Best of the Seattle Kitchen. My name is Sean. Thanks for tuning in here to Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Usually I'm behind the scenes, but today I am in front of the scenes. It's lovely. It's lovely being here. So today on the show, well, Jackie Cross is going to drop by. Yeah, that's Tom's wife. She works. She's the head farmer at Prosser Farms. We've got Abra Barron's dropping by. Again, Andy Ricker from Pock Pock is going to be dropping by to chat about noodles and why they matter. But coming up right now, we have an adventurer, a food and travel adventurer named Debbie Campbell. And Tom, why don't you just take it away, sir, here on the Best of the Seattle Kitchen.
We've invited Debbie Campbell in. Debbie Campbell, tell us about your adventures with your husband.
Thanks, Tom. Well, I'm a senior nomad. My husband and I are the senior nomads, and we have been traveling for the last 2.5 years, so we've been in 45 different countries, and I love to cook. We are on a budget, so we cook in most of the time, and we've decided that when it comes to treating each other for something special, he goes to football matches and I go to cooking classes when I can.
So that's what I wanted to talk to you about, because you know, I hear a lot of interest. People I talk to want to know, if I'm going to Italy, is there a good cooking school that you know of? And you've actually, not in every marketplace, but you've done maybe 6 or 8 cooking schools throughout Europe. And are there favorites? Are there things you should look for? How did you pick the ones that you actually went to?
You know, sometimes I do the research ahead of time and either you know, look online and look at the reviews. That's where TripAdvisor can be helpful. Sometimes our hosts, because we stay exclusively in Airbnbs, so I can usually count on our hosts to have some ideas. And I save it up for cuisines that I don't know much about and I want to learn about.
That's a good idea.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've been to cooking classes in Paris. I did a pastry class with my daughter that lives there. That was really fun. In Morocco, we went deep on tangine cooking, which was really cool, and it included a tour of the market and shopping. And we learned how to make couscous from the way that they mm-hmm. do in Morocco, where mm-hmm. you steam it first mm-hmm. and then you rake through it. It's a three-level process, and we saw our chickens slaughtered before our very eyes. In Barcelona, I learned the ins and outs of paella, including cleaning cuttlefish, which was really interesting.
Cuttlefish just being a small small octopus, right?
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But all that ink.
With the big center bone.
You have to cut the bone out, cut the ink sac out. Right?
Yeah, it was. You were just a disaster by the time you were done with that. But it was really, really good. Jerusalem took a really interesting Jewish cooking class there.
What stands out from a Jewish food? Because when Jackie was traveling to Jordan and Israel She loved the Israeli cooking.
It was really just vegetable centric. Uh-huh. This particular class, and again, kind of the couscous based thing. And we had some really lovely. I'm trying to remember what fish it was, but it was during Passover, so it was an interesting time because there was no bread. So there was just alternatives to that, and so that was a good one. And the other one I want to be sure and tell you is in Bari, Italy, we were on a walking tour. We always take a free walking tour. And I often take the market tours when I can. But this guy, we were going down a little alley, and he knocked on a door. And this little woman opened it, and it was a friend of his mother. And she is one of the best orecchietti makers in Bari. And she invited us in, and we sat at the kitchen table, and she taught me how to make this for an hour. Using a little kitchen knife, and you just roll the mm-hmm. little things uh-huh. off the dough.
With
and,
your thumbprint, right?
Well, yeah. She tried, yeah. So I did some thumb and then did some knife. The thumb ones were easier, but boy, there's an art to that. Mm. And she'd just sit there all night and make them trays of them that were racked up. So that was kind of interesting. I think that's probably my cooking school experiences at this point. And then I always download recipes that are, the cuisine of where I'm staying and see if I can fake it.
Terry, have you ever you have cooking schools? Like we had Susan Herman Loomis here, who has the cooking sure. school in France. What's it called? En Route Tatin?
Route Tatin, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. I did, when I went to India, that was one of the first things I did when I got to Bangalore, was to take a cooking class from a lady, actually the lady that was taking care of the house. You know, they, like you said, some country come with a person. You know, they have a servant or... and this person taught me how to do a chicken korala, which is more southern Indian, you know, the coconut and everything. She took the coconut. That was the first thing she did. She took the coconut and broke it on the floor. I was like, I want to do that in my kitchen.
Wow.
She took the coconut and went, bam. And
then pays to have a stone floor.
Yeah, and she discarded. She took the juice, put it on the side, and then she used the meat, obviously the fresh meat. But and then at the end of my trip, which was 8 days later, we went for a trip around Bangalore, and then at the end of the trip, I took another cooking class from a lady from Mumbai, you know, from the northern part of India, and I was told, same thing, I wanted the chicken, because chicken is easy to use as a base to reproduce anything. So the first one was with more with the southern style, coconut, sweet, and vegetable. And the northern part was really hot, spicy. And, you know, me and hot spice, that was great. But it was not hot to the point where you couldn't eat it. It was really well done, beautiful spice, you know, show you how to render all your spices in canola oil or in ghee. You know, they take the ghee and they just put all the spices in there, which is a very big trick.
Did you collect a lot of spices to bring back?
Yeah. Oh. I brought all kinds of spices. Yeah. I still have some, you know, it was 5 years ago.
That's what I travel with is spices.
I just can't throw them away because I have a few in bags. I'm like, oh, man. I don't have enough to make a big chicken.
It's not only that, but they're not very good anymore. Exactly.
But for me, it's a souvenir that I just love because it's reminiscent. But we have a rule that if you can't eat it, drink it, sleep in it, or do it, you can't buy it. because we're on a budget.
You're on a budget, and you have, two suitcases that you travel
with? Two suitcases and two backpacks. So spices are an easy thing to take from place to place.
Yeah, one of the things that I really love is to bring fresh turmeric. From India, I brought back some fresh turmeric.
And it's so affordable. And saffron and all the things cheap, that we spend so much money on here.
Absolutely.
Sumac, I have like a sack of it. And harissa,
I just think if you go, I think the marketplaces are the first place to go to get a sense of your neighborhood and a place. And then if you can learn a little bit about the local cooking, I think you really have a sense of where you've been.
Yeah, you live like a local, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, people don't cook when they're on vacation usually, and we have to. So you're kind of forced to get out there and do that.
I always cook when I go on vacation. It's a rule. We get a house. We have a kitchen.
Yeah.
That's like number one thing to do.
Well, so many of these Airbnbs, no one's ever cooked in. I've been the first person to use the stove. I mean, people just don't. They use the coffee maker and the toaster.
Right. And they go out to restaurants.
And they go out.
But you've been doing it
time.
For 2.5 years. So you have a little different sense about it.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is that one of the cool things about Airbnb is you have a dining room.
Yeah.
And like when we ended up in Paris for 5 weeks, we know a lot of people, and many of them happen to be in Paris, and we had people over for dinner.
All the time.
Throwing
a
dinner party
right?
in another city is really kind of an interesting affair. Really
we found a one bedroom in New York City with a deck overlooking a neighborhood garden. It's like we were like 5 blocks away from Broadway. No, 3 blocks from Broadway.
All right, you're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Thanks, Debbie Campbell, for joining us again here at Seattle's News and Seattle's Talk Station.
Yeah, we're getting dirty on this Seattle Kitchen. And hip. We're getting hip as well, because this is a band called Goodbye Heart, a song called Don't Slow Down. Good local people. Not sure if they're still together anymore, but they are a great band. Check them out. My name is Sean. I'm behind the scenes, usually here at Cairo, also Seattle Kitchen. We have another Best of Seattle Kitchen because Tom and Terry, they're not done gallivanting. So coming up in this segment, a while ago we had an author named Abra Behrens drop by with her new cookbook called Roughage. You know, I remember growing up, parents always saying, you need to get a little roughage in your diet. That's why you can't, BM or whatever. Because you need some roughage. Well, we're about to learn all about some roughage, but first and foremost, what would you like to say?
First and foremost, thanks so much for having me. I've been a big fan for a long time, so it's really an honor to be talking with you. Grainer Farm is in southwest Michigan, so we are about 60 miles just north around the lake from Chicago, and we are first and foremost a vegetable farm. We have we're certified organic vegetables, and we also do a lot of small grain production. So we grow a lot of wheat and rye, some barley, kernza, spelt, corn, things like that. And we're in a really beautiful part of Michigan. It's right along the water, so nice sandy beaches, and then really rolling hills, and we grow a ton of vegetables and fruit in our area.
A place that was frozen solid just 2 months ago.
It's true. Yeah, the transition from winter to spring is always very dramatic and very welcome.
So your new book is called Roughage, A Practical Guide to Vegetables. Tell us a little bit about that and why you wrote it and what you're trying to teach people.
Absolutely. So I started farming in 2009, about a year and a half after graduating from the cookery school Ballymaloe, which is in the south of Ireland. And it was at cooking school, you know, Ballymaloe is also on a working organic farm. And so it was there that I started thinking about, as a chef, could my role be to make food that was really of a place and really tied to the agriculture of a region. I grew up on a farm, and that always kind of stayed with me. So after cooking school, I moved back to Chicago and started working in restaurants there, and then started a farm in 2009. And it was there that I realized, A, you know, how much I love vegetables and working with them and featuring them at the kind of the center of the plate, which was not something I was familiar with. I grew up in a very like meat eating household, very classic Midwestern meat and potatoes. And so it was a combination of really emphasizing vegetables in my own cooking. And then also, you know, working a farmer's market stall every week and answering the same questions week in and week out, like, you know, what do I do with a beet? How do I cook a beet? What is kohlrabi? What is this crazy looking thing with a bunch of leaves coming out the top? And, you know, what's the best way to cook winter squash? How long will it last? Things like that. So the book really came out of my desire to share some of my experiences both as a farmer and a chef and answer some of those questions for people. I think everyone's trying to eat more vegetables these days, but still feeling like they're at a little bit of a loss for what some of the next steps are.
So, Abra, you are coming out of big winter in the Midwest. What's the first thing you're looking forward to?
I mean, right now we are thick in ramp season. Do you guys have ramps in Seattle?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So there's parts of the country that don't have them, but they're these amazing wild leeks that are one of the first foraged items that we get from our woods. So they are a very funky, garlicky, oniony leek. So I really love those, especially grilled, like the first time you're getting the grill going again and grilling some ramps and then topping it with any number of sauces or even just like hard cooked egg and grated garlicky breadcrumbs. I really love that in the spring. I also really love asparagus, and asparagus is one of those ingredients for us that is really the like hallmark of the start of produce season in a real way. I mean, we have produce year round that's local, but asparagus is really kind of the darling of the spring. And, you know, the way that Roughage is organized is to break each ingredient out by a preparation technique. So for asparagus, it's, you know, roasted, grilled, and then raw. And trying to have some new ideas for people, it was a real revelation to me to eat raw asparagus, that it's so creamy and crunchy that you don't even really need to cook it. And you can shave it really thinly and toss it into a salad.
So a question for you, as you explore vegetables in your book, is there one that Americans in general just don't appreciate and you found the best way to serve it? Like, in the beginning of the show, I teased rutabaga, and I don't think there's a lot of appreciation for rutabaga. Have you found a way to make it edible?
I also love rutabaga and turnips. I think that they have sort of a coarse reputation, but they're often really sweet. And one of my favorite ways to prepare them is, again, to have them raw. But sometimes they're that kind of, like, brassica, funky, farty, for lack of a better word, sort of taste to them. And oftentimes I'll just give them a quick rinse under cool water, and that helps wick some of that sulfuric acid out. And they're really nice in a raw salad. I like to dress them either with an anchovy vinaigrette, or I make this this dressing that I affectionately call Trashy Ranch, because I love ranch dressing. But it takes a little while to make. And so one of my favorite dressings that's in the book is, again, pickle liquid Trashy Ranch dressing. It's just equal parts mayonnaise and then reserved pickle liquid, like from whatever jar. And it sounds gross, and I know that it sounds gross. You just shake that up. But it's so tangy and creamy and wonderful. And especially with something like raw turnip or rutabaga, you know, they're like a hearty, kind of not always very sexy vegetable. So I really like dressing them with something kind of rich and creamy and tangy.
Sounds delicious, and I'm going to go buy a rutabaga, and I'm going to rinse or pare all the wax that they put on it off of it. Because they sit in the grocery store so long, they have to wax them so they don't dehydrate and discolor. Abra Behrens has been our guest. Her new cookbook is called Roughage. It's the practical guide to vegetables. She was calling into us from Michigan, southern Michigan on the lake. Last time I was in that area, I was playing golf at Whistling Straits up north of Milwaukee, in Sheboygan, Milwaukee.
Wow.
So.
I'm from Sheboygan.
Thank you so much, Abra. I appreciate your time, and good luck on the book.
Thank you so much, and thanks again for having me.
You're welcome, Abra. It was nice having you on the show today. My name is Sean. This is the Best of Seattle Kitchen. Coming up next segment, let me just see, what do I have here? We're going to have Eric Silverstein of the Peach Tortilla. He's going to drop by, and he's going to make some fried rice in studio. So that's coming up next on the Best of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM, Seattle's News, Seattle's Talk. Wu-Tang Clan bringing us back in here on Cairo Radio. My name is Sean. This is the Best of Seattle Kitchen. Not sure when Tom and Terry will be back because, you know, gallivanting is fun. And when you've got food and money at your disposal, what are you going to do? Anyway, they're going to be back soon. Trust me, folks. Anyway, coming up in this segment of the Seattle Kitchen, Eric Silverstein of the Peached Tortilla. He's going to teach us how to make his favorite Asian Southern fusion fried rice. But, Eric, I have a question for you. What do you call it?
I call it the number 60 fried rice on our menu. It's named in honor of the food truck I started in, which was route number 60. I started the business in a lanchera about 9 years ago. Very small operation. And we started as, honestly, a street food taco truck, and then grew the business. And in our restaurant, we expanded the menu. And this is one of our kind of Asian comfort food items. My mother's Chinese. I grew up eating a lot of Chinese food at home. But I also spent 12 years living in Japan. So our food is kind of a fusion of all those things. A lot of Asian influence.
And now, where's home?
Home is in Austin.
Austin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Austin, Texas. Yeah.
So you can find your restaurant in Austin, Texas.
That's right. Yeah. We have three locations. Our brick and mortar is on Burnett Road. And then we have another location called Bar Peach, which is a bar-focused restaurant concept. And then we have one inside of Austin Bergstrom International Airport.
Nice.
Which is a fast casual outlet. That's more like a street food menu.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
So, yeah.
All right. So what are we doing?
So we got some oil in the wok, just not on super high heat. I'm going to start with a little bit of ginger and a little bit of garlic.
Both are chopped really fine.
Good sound effects. I hope you're in your garden picking vegetables right now to this sound, dreaming of making a stir fry.
And then I'm just going to add some shiitake mushrooms and lapchang.
So lapchang is one of my favorite ingredients, and my daughter and I used to, it's a Chinese sweet sausage, and my daughter and I used to fight for the center sausage in the Nor Mai Gai at dim sum, which is the sticky rice wrapped in the lotus leaf.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to kind of stir fry these ingredients first. Just kind of get them cooked a little bit way through. I'm doing about a half portion of the recipe in the book, just because I don't want to overload the wok.
And right.
I kind of advise readers to kind of split the recipe in half if they don't have a wok, if they're doing it at home, just kind of in a regular, like, carbon steel skillet or just a nonstick Teflon pan.
I've also found, I don't know how you feel about this, is that sauteing each of the ingredients separately so that you can get the proper sear on them.
Yeah.
And then just adding everything back to the wok when you go for the rice.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, actually, in the recipe in the book, I advise our readers to cook, scramble the eggs separately,
right,
instead of doing it in the same pan. Because otherwise, if you scramble the eggs with the rice and all the other ingredients, then you get this coating on all your ingredients, and it's just not the best fried rice texturally.
So, Eric, do you get beat up a little bit for the whole fusion thing, or because you're Chinese American, do you get away with it?
I think fusion gets a really bad rap, and I think it's unfair. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in Asia and Japan, Japanese fuse all kinds of American
mm-hmm.
food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of my favorite fast food restaurants, like Mos Burger, is fusion. So I think it's unfortunate that mm-hmm. fusion gets the rap. I mean, guys have done fusion really well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you've ever eaten at Roy's restaurant.
Roy Yamaguchi.
Roy Yamaguchi. I mean, his food is fantastic. I think fusion, unfortunately, gets kind of a bad rap.
The word fusion got bad rap because there was a lot of confusion in some people doing it, not knowing what they were doing, as opposed to people just practicing regular cooking.
There was that, but there was also, I think, a lot of the old-timers that weren't ready for change in our food, right?
Look
at a lot of the French chefs, or look at even Madeleine Common, and Barbara Tropp, Alice Waters. You know, they just did not accept any sort of mingling of cultures.
Right, right,
yeah.
right.
So I just added some day-old rice. There's a debate as to whether, you know, you should use day-old rice for fried rice. I like to.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of dries the rice out a little bit, so it's not so sticky when you eat it. Mm-hmm. Final product.
You also have to use that rice no matter what. So
you can make congee out of it.
Exactly. You can make nice cakes. You can make all kind of stuff.
I love brown rice, fried rice.
Okay, I'm adding a little bit of oyster sauce. That's pretty traditional as far as the fried rice that I grew up eating.
Mm-hmm.
My mom always cooked with oyster sauce. The tweak that I made on this recipe is largely in the toppings. Also, just adding lochang. She didn't really make fried rice with lochang at home.
Right.
I like a little bit of velvetiness in the dish, and I'm adding a little bit of miso.
Mm-hmm.
We make a compound butter at the restaurant, and we do a kimchi miso compound butter and add it to the fried rice. But for the readers, I'm just kind of separating, just add miso and butter.
Miso paste. Miso butter.
Well, just remind you, we're cooking out of the book called The Peach Tortilla, Modern Asian Comfort Food from Tokyo to Texas with Eric Silverstein.
So a little trick, Eric, nothing is sticking to your wok. That is pretty impressive. You keep moving everything around.
I got a little bit stuck in the bottom when I added the egg. That's why I kind of recommend that you cook the egg separately and then just add it back in at the end.
Right.
I'm going a little bit off recipe from the book just because I'm used to cooking it all in one pan.
Right.
Yeah. And then this dish is pretty much done. Since the rice is already cooked, it's not like I'm trying to cook the rice. I'm just putting it together and I'm going to plate it up.
Are you a browner of rice in fried rice? Because when you go to Chinese restaurants, they never brown it. It's almost always just like re-steamed.
I like to get a little bit of texture at the bottom. So towards the end of the process, I'll let the rice sit for a second to get a little bit of texture on the bottom of the rice. But I don't want to take it too far. It's kind of like if you take it too far, then it's too crispy, and then
it's dry.
The texture is just off.
Yeah. I get a little carried away because I like a little brown on it. I'm probably better off with those Korean stone pot kind of fried rice.
A bibimbap.
Where you put the fried rice into this burning hot stone pot, and then a crust on the bottom and around the side.
It looks glistening. It looks very nice and hot. What are those you're putting on?
So I'm adding rice puffs. So these are the Vietnamese spring roll wrappers that you would use for a cold spring roll. So the ones that you would soak into hot water.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of soaking them in hot water, you just put them right into a deep fryer at 350. They puff up in about 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. I really like them because they add texture to the dish. But on top of that, I use them, I pull them apart, use them as a chip. If we're doing like appetizers, mm-hmm, I'll do like a tuna tartare, beef tartare, something like that.
Well, you know, it's so much prettier than the classic Chinese-style shrimp chips that you can buy, which just come out.
Much more delicate.
These are much more delicate.
I was actually kind of inspired. I put these on because I was watching, I think, some bit with Danny Bowen, and he did this fried rice dish, and he like threw a bunch of Lay's potato chips on top of it. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I don't know if I want to do Lay's potato chips, but I came up with something that I felt like it needed some more texture in the dish. So that's why I ended up doing that.
That's because you refused to brown it.
Also, you put a bunch of chopped green onion, and now you're putting what? What is that?
I'm just putting some cilantro on top, and then I'm going to add some peach pickled red onions. Just a little twist, a little acid to finish the dish up.
What does that mean, peach pickled?
So we pickle it in peach tea. So we actually make some peach tea, brew some peach tea, a little bit of rice wine vinegar, salt, sugar, a little bit of hibiscus for added color.
So it's adds more a little color thing. Fruitiness and color?
Fruitiness and color, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, if people want to stop by your restaurant in Austin, please feel free. It sounds like there's a couple of different options between the Peach Bar and the Peach Tortilla and a food truck. Eric Silverstein is his name. His new book is called The Peach Tortilla, Modern Asian Comfort Food from Tokyo to Texas. It's available at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
Absolutely. Please come check the book out at Booklarder or get it on Amazon, either one.
Right on. Thanks, Eric. I was there that day when this segment was recorded, and that fried rice was delicious, and it smelled so good. Fried rice is so easy to make. I hope that you do try to make it someday, listener, Cairo listener. My name is Sean. This is the Best of Seattle Kitchen. Coming up next, we've got Andy Ricker from Pock Pock. Yeah, he joined us last week, but he's joining us again, this time to talk all about noodles, Asian noodles. This is Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen, the best of Seattle Kitchen. My name is Sean. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I do appreciate your listenership, Cairo listener. So coming up right here in this segment of the Seattle Kitchen, we've got Andy Ricker of Pock Pock. He was here last week chatting about his new book. But this time around, he's going to be informing us all about rice noodles and what to do with them and why they are so delicious. But first, Tom, what were you just telling Terry?
So I was just telling Terry, I love the big fat white rice noodles. The pad seyu is what I get them with in Thai restaurants. I use the chung phun, which are the wide rice noodles that are kind of rolled with green onions, maybe some dried shrimp sometimes. You see them in dim sum restaurants. But I'm just a big fan of these rice noodles. Your book seems to have, I was just looking at a recipe, I can't say it, but I was looking at it. Kuapet. You know what I'm talking about?
With your Kuapet. Yes.
Yes. Tom always had a very, very high, a good foreign language cane on this one.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for that, Chef. Anyway, let's talk rice noodles. You know, there's the Korean style that are kind of hard, sliced out of a bias from a roll, and then there's these more Chinese style that are made from ground rice that are kind of what we consider fresh noodles, even though they're just kind of rice, ground up rice. So can you talk about rice noodles for us?
Sure. So in Thailand, kwet kio basically means rice noodle or noodles in general, but more specifically rice noodles. So kwet kio sen lek, which is small, sen mi, which is very, very thin, like an angel hair. And sen yai, which is the most common versions of rice noodles. Sen yai is the one that you're talking about, also known as paw pan, I think, or chow pan.
Yeah, exactly.
My Chinese isn't so great. But the way that they're made is really interesting. And if you get the book, we have a whole photograph sort of story in there that shows the process. So they take jasmine rice flour, and they have a mill, and they just mill it in-house. Big giant stone grinder, and they mill it with a little bit of water to create this very, very fine paste, like a slurry more. And then they add a little bit of tapioca starch to it, and that gives the noodles some snap and chewiness and flexibility. That was something I didn't realize until I went through the factory with these guys. This is one of their little secrets. There's a little bit of tapioca flour. And then they take the slurry, they load it into a hopper, and it gets fed onto a long conveyor belt that goes through a steamer in a very thin layer. And then it comes out of the steamer and it goes through a series of rollers that are oiled with vegetable oil, and it comes out in a long sheet, and then they slice it into whatever shape you want it to be. And then if you're lucky, it never gets refrigerated, because as soon as it gets refrigerated, all the oil and the starch and everything kind of seize up and it gets hard. And it's really hard to get them back into a form that's, you know, texturally good after that. So if you're lucky enough to live in L.A., there's a factory or two down here, and they deliver directly to the stores in the morning, and you can grab the packet and it's still warm.
Wow.
And that's the stuff you want. If you're up in Seattle, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure what you'll find is the refrigerated version of that is also comes from the same factories down here in L.A.
We have our own. Chu Chung Noodle Factory makes fresh rice noodles. At Wajimaya,
fantastic,
which is a big market here in downtown, you can get the warm Chung Phun. They don't refrigerate it either, and they do a beautiful job. And that's probably where I fell in love with it first, was having gone through the factory with the Henry family. And they do all sorts of noodles, but the rice noodle thing I thought was fascinating. Just like you said, the thin batter onto the steamer and layering it, and it's just it's awesome.
You can also make it at home. You don't have to have a rice. You can get rice flour and tapioca flour and make a slurry, and then make a little pot with it and stretch a very fine, almost like a cheesecloth over the top, and then ladle it on. And then that's how they make the rice rolls that we were talking about for dim sum before on the street.
Right.
So you can actually do it yourself if you can't get the fresh stuff. it's a little more, it's a fun experience doing it. But it's a bit of a commitment.
Yeah, making noodle from scratch is definitely a commitment.
Always. Let's talk about the noodles that are becoming so popular right now. They're not really what we perceive as noodles, but it's the rice cakes that are kind of a roll that's cut on the bias and used like a noodle. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. They don't really have a tradition of that in Thailand. They have other things that are interesting and unique, but not that particular. That's a Korean thing, right? The Korean rice cakes. Yeah. Those are delicious, too. Those are fantastic.
But they pan fry up beautifully, as do the rice noodles, so you can get them nice and crispy and lovely. And my favorite is at a Korean restaurant here in town. They do it with tomato sauce and hot dogs, with those little rice cakes. Very popular.
Yes.
Other ways to use rice noodles. I mean, everyone knows about pho, which is generally a rice noodle. So any other thoughts about rice noodles?
Sure. So pho is also called fenlek in Thai. So that's the smaller rice noodle. There's also the noodles they use they call sen pad thai, which looks like the pho noodle, except for it's about twice as wide.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff is semi-dried, so it's still flexible. And you buy it in the refrigeration section. That's a quick soak before you cook them. Or if you're going to boil them for soup, you just drop in the boiler. The other interesting noodle that doesn't see much action here is called senmi. It's the very, very thin rice noodle, and it's really nice for delicate soups. Like if you want to do the chicken noodle soup, if you use senmi, the very, very thin version, it's quite nice. It's more delicate, and it works really well with the broth. And that you can buy, there's a Thai brand called YY, W-A-I-W-A-I, and they make a very, very thin one. Those are really, they cook really, really quickly, and they just got a nice texture to them.
Would that work well in salad as well?
Yes, I believe it would, though typically what you see more often is you would see wunsen or glass noodle.
Uh-huh.
Which is, you know, again another Chinese noodle. And just a quick note here, basically all the noodles in the Thai canon are Chinese in origin. They don't really, the only noodle that they have that they can kind of claim as indigenous is kunum chin, which is a fresh rice noodle. And it also, I find that whole noodle to be absolutely fascinating. And there's a whole chapter on it in the book, shows the procedure. It's a really amazing tradition. It'll take me a long time to explain what's going on, but essentially it's a fermented rice flour batter that they extrude and make this really fine rice vermicelli that's fresh and it's delicious.
Such a beautiful, intricate world.
Our guest has been Andy Ricker. He's got a new book out called Puck Puck Noodles, available in every store in America. 10-Speed Press is the publisher. Thanks for spending a few minutes with us, Andy. I appreciate it both this week and last.
Mazer, blowing your eardrums out of your head here on Cairo Radio, another local band who I've interviewed. They're so fantastic. My name is Sean. This is the Best of Seattle Kitchen. We have a whole nother hour to go with some really great stuff coming up. Plus, one segment that has not even aired, so I'm not even sure if it's considered a best of. That's coming up next hour here. Stay tuned on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Best of the Seattle Kitchen. My name is Sean, usually behind the scenes, but now I'm in front of the scene, and got to tell you, it feels pretty nice. So coming up right now in this segment of the Best of Seattle Kitchen, we're heading to Darby Winery in Woodinville to squash some grapes and drink some wine. So stay tuned if you want to get a little crunk. Yeah, no, that's not even the right term. I am not hip. I recently bruised my hip.
Darby English, and I'm owner of Darby Winery. Started making wine in my basement in West Seattle in 2001, so I took the hard route of doing it and doing it myself. So I worked my day job and made wine in my basement, and luckily I befriended some winemakers that were just getting started in Woodinville in the early 2000s, like my good friend Mark Ryan and a few other really successful guys, and kind of saw what they were doing and wanted to be a part of kind of the wine culture. So started making wine in my basement and fell in love with the whole process of creating something. And, you know, kind of as the neighbors started asking for a little bit more wine, then I figured I might as well start selling it. So we went commercial in 2005 and did about 400 cases of wine. So we did 250 cases of really good Syrah and about 150 cases of Viognier Roussan, and then opened a tasting room in Woodinville in 2006. So it's changed a little bit since then, but we're happy we started kind of when we did. We do about 4,000 to 5,000 cases, depending on the yields, because with Mother Nature, on a hot year like this, they'll give us a little bit more because we'll let more fruit hang out there. So yields will be a little bit bigger this year, but we're in that 4,000 to 5,000 case range, which is kind of where I want to be. You know, it's kind of that life balance for me. I like to work hard, but then I also like to go fly fish a lot, so, and hang out with my daughter. So it's kind of that we're going to stick at the 4,000 to 5,000 case range for the foreseeable future and just keep it fun. You know, I'm one of those winemakers that I'm still here getting my hands dirty. And at this stage, there's a lot of other winemakers that have hired winemakers, and now they're running the business, which is fine, but I didn't sign up for this to run the business. I want to still make wine and go to the vineyards and be a part of that. So if I go past 5,000 cases, then I have more employees, more warehouses, and all that stuff, and I just don't want to do that. When I was making, you know, 400 cases, I kind of knew that I was just going to make wine that I like to drink. I wasn't a big white wine drinker. I had to do research, which was pretty fun to do, drink a lot of different white wines and figure out what I liked. And I love the Rhone stuff. So I love Viognier, Roussans, Marsans, and found a really good source for some Viognier and a little bit of Roussan, and then figured that I'd just make some of that. And I knew I'd have enough friends and family that would at least buy half of it because they like to drink a lot. And just went from there. Just kind of, you know, the first couple of years, it's kind of nice because you can afford to do that and figure out, you know, what you like and what you want to make and figure that people will buy it. But, you know, since then, we've had to look at other varieties that I may necessarily not be my favorite, but we have to make because I know the people out there, you know, that's what they consume. And I've since actually like Cab Franc and a few other ones that I didn't like before since the fact that I've had to make them. So pretty much 90% of what we use is really good French oak. French oak is just a little bit better, in my opinion, than American oak, although American oak is making some vast improvements. It's just a little bit too strong for the style of wine I want to make. But we do use some American oak for something like, say, Petite Syrah that can handle that. So you have to figure out which wines like different types of oak, and there's different forests in France that we choose for different wines, different coopers or producers. They're all made by hand, and these guys are artisans, so they make little fires over each individual barrel, and then they move it by hand over the fire to actually get the toast level. So these are really handcrafted barrels, and the French oak is just really, really subtle, and we use probably about 50 to 60% new French oak on our Bordeaux stuff. We also like to have neutral barrels in here, too, in case it gets a little oaky. Then we can add some of those neutral barrels back in the blend to kind of tone down that oak influence in the wine and get it to where we want it.
You know, it's interesting. The last time I crushed grapes with my feet was at the Italian Festival at Seattle Center, which was every year. I don't know if that happened this year or not. I didn't hear much
Festal.
About it.
I think it's called Festal.
Yeah, Festal d'Italia or something like that. So anyway, that's the last time I did that.
We're out here crushing wine with our feet, literally.
Yeah.
Is that a common thing out here in Woodinville, or are you one of many?
I'm not sure. I think a lot of people do whole cluster, like foot stomp with Syrah and some Rhone stuff, but I think a lot of wineries maybe get lazy and they don't do it, because as you can see, it's a lot of work. And maybe some wineries don't think it makes a difference, but in my experiments, I know that it makes a difference, and I think I like the old school. They do a lot in the Rhone Valley, and I can just taste the difference, and I've done a lot of experiments on doing it and not doing it, and it turns out really, really good. It's kind of hard to put into words, but if you taste the difference, you can really tell. It's just a kind of mid-palate. There's much more complexity to it. It may not be as dark and kind of as big of a fruit bomb as people are used to in Washington, but it's going to drink much more European Rhone-like, which I'm kind of going for. And I think we can get a lot of that stuff through just fermentation techniques and making the right decisions and picking in the vineyard and those type of things.
Where are we going to find Darby? Is it grocery stores, restaurants locally, or?
Just a good mix of grocery stores, you know, Whole Foods, Met Markets, all the little wine shops around. Restaurants, we're in a few good restaurants. In our tasting room in Woodinville here. I mean, if people haven't been out to Woodinville, we encourage them to come out and taste. It's really fun to come out on the weekends and bring friends. And we're distributing in New York and D.C. and a little bit in Austin, Texas, and a little bit out of state, but I think we're focusing on Northwest. People love Washington wine and Oregon wine, so we're going to focus just on selling it here more than any other place.
So you brought us some wine. Now, please please be clear that this isn't the wine you've been stomping in.
Oh, Tom, you know very well that the wine that I was stomping in is processed enough. It's going to be the most delicious vintage.
And we know you've got clean feet, too.
I do. No, we aren't drinking Darby's native rosé wine, which is quite delicious. And if you see the bottle, it's got salmon on it, because he is concerned, as we all are right now, about the salmon
population. Sure, here in the Sound. And so, is it raising money for any particular cause?
Yep, it goes to an organization. I'll let Darby tell you all about it.
Yes, it's a really cool wine that we have called Native. A good friend of mine who's a local artist called Casey Underwood did a really awesome label for us. And then 10% goes back to Wild Steelhead Conservation. So I'm working with the Wild Steelhead Coalition on this, which is a great group of guys and really good fishermen as well. And we all like to go spay cast and swing flies for wild steelhead on the Washington-Oregon coast. But the counts of steelhead have been really down the last 10, 15 years, and it's getting to a point where somebody needs to do something about it. And working with the coalition, they were excited when I approached them because they were looking for ways to get the message out there, and it's hard for them. They do a good job on social media and on their website, but this is just going to be kind of the random person that sees this wine and reads the story on the back might encourage them to donate and to get involved in this. So we're really excited. We have some really popular restaurants kind of picking this up and that are, they're fly fishermen and they want to support the local cause. Because people don't know that, steelhead's the Washington fish. So you should get that out there. But no, we're super excited about this brand, and I think it needs to be done. And we're just getting started with this, too. So we have a native club, too, which is going to be a really awesome wine club. So we're doing, for $35 a bottle, you get 6 bottles or a case a year of Red Mountain Cabernet. So typically those wines go for $40 to $60. We're going to make it $35. And that way, 10% goes back to the Wild Steelhead Coalition. So you're not only getting great wine, but you're giving 10% back to the coalition all in one shot.
Super fun weekend with Darby at Darby Winery. Hey, if you don't want to make it all the way out to Woodinville and you live close to Seattle, keep your eyes open because Darby will be opening a wine bar soon in West Seattle. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
Little Rage Against the Machine bringing us back in here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. My name is Sean. Thanks for tuning in to the best of Seattle Kitchen. Tom and Terry will be back. I'm not sure when, but it will be soon. I mean, they're gallivanting. And how many times can I use the word gallivant or gallivanting in a two-hour show? Probably a lot more than just the few times I've done it. So coming up in this segment, we've got author Sarah Dickerman. She's here to tell us about her new cookbook, Secrets of Great Second Meals. But Tom, first off, what will you say?
And here's what I'll say, considering your book is all about second meals.
Yes.
Horseradish is one of those little nubbins that ends up in your vegetable drawer because you've bought it for the big prime rib dinner, but you never use the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do you do with it now? What do you do with that little nubbin?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think we have directly addressed it in the book. I would say one thing you can do, of course, is go ahead and grate the whole thing and put it in vinegar, and you have your little condiment, and it's ready to go.
And it'll last in your fridge forever, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Pickling is always a good safety for anything you're not sure what doing with.
So that would be one thing. But just, a little scraped on top of your pan-roasted veggies that you're doing anyway for your weeknight sort of healthy dinner, as it comes out of the oven, just...
Yeah, beautiful grated in salads. Yeah. Think about it like wasabi a little bit. It just will go with it pretty much anything.
Right, and it takes a while to decompose.
Let's talk about your new book.
Yeah,
very exciting. I just got a copy the other day. It's at my office. Tell us about the inspiration and what you're going to do with it and all that sort of thing.
Sure, absolutely. So there's sort of multi-part inspiration. My mother was a very frugal cook and, always took very good care to make sure we were eating what we had left over. She had been born at the very end of the Depression, and I think a lot of those habits still stuck with her. And, of course, that was annoying when I was a kid, but, it still gets under your skin somehow. And then when I started cooking in restaurants, restaurants are very careful, as you know, with food costs. And you want to make sure you're getting the most out of every bit of food that you've spent your money on. And that doesn't mean serving poor quality food, but it means being inventive and making sure that you're using your ingredients to their fullest capacity. That means making stocks to make sauces. That means serving a family meal perhaps with some of the things that aren't quite easy to serve to customers but are delicious anyway. Mm-hmm. And thinking about all those things really caused me to be more inventive with the way I thought about food. So I was thinking about that, and then, of course, food waste has become a much bigger issue in our consciousness in the past few years. The idea that we are wasting about 40% of our food in this country is kind of shocking, and it's not just money that you're throwing away, but, you know, you're creating more carbon output, all the food miles, transportation miles, all the packaging that goes into this food. And even though working at home, we can't take care of all of that, if we're a little more conscientious, we certainly can reduce the amount of waste we're doing at home. Mm-hmm. So that's all the sort of scoldy stuff. And then the really fun stuff is, I just think it's like a great way to get started on the next meal. If I don't know, I just look, it's like a writer's prompt. Mm-hmm. That little thing of roasted carrots in my refrigerator is like, I'm here, what are you going to do with me? Mm-hmm. And so it's just a springboard for creativity in the kitchen for me.
Couldn't agree more.
I know. I'm 100% going, yes, yes, yes. Check and check.
I made a salad last night. I was going to save this, too late for that, but out of escarole and all the different little roasted veggies I had left in my fridge. Mm-hmm. So I just took the escarole, and it's just an ingredient I don't use enough, and I don't think people do either, because I always see it in the produce section up in the upper right-hand corner where nobody goes, right? So it's beautiful escarole right now. It's that time of year. Just did a quick wilt in hot olive oil, and then just added my roasted veggies to that and had a beautiful salad, a winter salad.
Right.
And those are the kind of things that little bowl of roasted carrots kind of spur on.
Right, and it adds a little elegance to your salad that would have, and a little heft to your salad, so it feels like a salad is enough for dinner. Of course, escarole is pretty rich in itself, but, you know, like that little extra texture. I'm always looking for ways of, when you're looking at second meals, I think you always want to be thinking about ways of adding new layers of flavor, new layers of texture, to reframe whatever it is you have, so it feels like a special dish that has its own identity and not just sort of, you know, the cold stuff out of the fridge.
I know. First thing I thought of was, roasted carrots. I got a can of garbanzo beans. Now I've got roasted carrot hummus, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's little things that you can just jump right on.
Oh, and then a blender is, you're thinking blender, food processor. Mm-hmm. What a great thing, because you can also almost always puree leftover vegetables or with a little bit of broth, whether that's a vegetable broth or a dashi or a chicken stock, and you've got a great little soup.
You got a brand new start.
So I encourage people to cook kind of simply the first time. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean without flavor, but that means making a great pot of beans with, you know, classic combination of, you know, garlic and some bay.
Bacon.
And bacon if you want it. Or doing a great pork shoulder with, again, garlic. You know me, I like garlic. Or doing, you know, either a roast chicken, or I love doing a chicken in a pot because it's even more tender throughout the week. And then you get the broth from that.
Yeah.
So you do
and
that
you get
kind
the
of
bones to make a stock later.
Exactly. So you do that at the beginning of the week, keep it a little simple, and then the next day, maybe those, maybe that pork is going to go into tacos, or maybe the chicken will go into a lovely ginger scallion chicken salad, like the one on the cover of the book.
Like the one on the cover of the book. Yeah, just a little lovely salad. Chef, we only have a couple minutes. What's your favorite, when you look in the fridge and you have no idea what you're going to make for dinner, what is your dream boat leftover left in that fridge?
I'm going to go with that chicken.
Roast chicken?
Yeah
you too, Sarah?
I think that, you know, we never, ever do anything but buy whole chicken.
Uh-huh.
And it just brings so many different type of cooking and dishes and everything. When you have a whole chicken, you can do so much. Even if you just roast that chicken, you have so much after that.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
The possibility, it's just like pork shoulder. It's a, you know, you take a big pork shoulder in the summertime, you put on your barbecue, you walk away, you know, come back from time to time.
6 hours later.
6 hours later. Yeah. And you have this piece of meat that is so diversifying. You know, it's like you can put it in soup, in bean stew, in sandwiches.
It keeps on giving.
It keeps on giving, you know. And that's how you should look at your week preparation. Instead of looking at it, oh, it's a big, you know, I got 5 minutes to make. Look at it as something that can be really exchanged that way, you know, that can really keep on giving.
Exactly.
Sarah, I think this is the kind of classic cookbook that people use to get ideas, inspirations by. And that's what's lovely about it for me is that
it'll resonate true with everyone who's got a kitchen and a fridge, right?
Right.
Because
Hopefully, you'll
see things in there that, oh, yeah, I could have done this with that or this with that. And I think it'll spur cooks on to be more creative, less wasteful, all the things that you're hoping to get out of this. It's a beautiful tome.
Thank you.
The book is called Secrets of Great Second Meals. Learn to Love Your Leftovers, Flexible Modern Recipes That Value Time and Limit Waste by Sarah Dickerman.
Coming up this next segment here on the Best of Seattle Kitchen, we're getting sweet with bartender Christian Rolick. He's going to teach us how to make delicious sweet vermouth. Oh, sweet vermouth. How I've missed you. My name is Sean. This is Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen, the best of the Seattle Kitchen, I should say. My name is Sean. Thanks for tuning in today. And I mean, I don't know how you could not feel happy listening to a bit of Gerardo, Rico Suave on loop. So you're welcome, Cairo listener, and essentially America. I haven't heard this song for so long, and it's probably for the better. But what is a nice fun fact, oh, and we'll get to the food soon enough. Weird Al Yankovic back in the day did a parody of this song, a parody of Rico Suave called Taco Grande. Listen to it. If you've not heard it, that'll make you feel probably a lot better than listening to this song on loop. Anyway, coming up in this segment of the Seattle Kitchen, we are not going to be talking about Gerardo or Weird Al Yankovic, unfortunately. But we do have someone named Christian dropping by to talk about sweet vermouth and how to make it, why it exists, and what he's all about. So that's coming up right now for you on the Best of the Seattle Kitchen here on Cairo Radio.
Well, why sweet vermouth? Why are you making that for us today? Is it the basis of a lot of cocktails?
No, well, it's the basis of classic cocktails. Mm-hmm. But like one of the things that I do at a Luke restaurant, I make all the side ingredients from scratch when you talk about cocktails. So I make sweet vermouth, I make dry vermouth, I make orange liqueur, cherry liqueur. And sweet vermouth is just fun to make. And so I thought, you know, I'm here with you guys.
Why not? I have never made, Terry, have you ever made sweet vermouth?
That's I'm very interested.
Yeah.
No, but it's kind of cool because it would never even come. It's not that expensive of an alcohol, so it actually doesn't come to my mind to actually make it, but now that I'm seeing that.
No, like, so the cool thing is, like, so I work in a restaurant, and like it's really set up, it's very small, everything is very tiny, so I try to figure out things, how to make the bar program special, because that's in essence what I do. I do the bar.
Well, that's true, you don't have a big bar.
No,
I've been there.
So I try to come up with things that make it cool and like, translate the philosophy of the back of the house to the front of the house. So everything is made from scratch in the back of the house.
Sure.
So why not do this in the front of the house?
I'm with you.
A lot of restaurants kind of forget about this. They kind of lift this philosophy in the back, and then when it comes to the front, they have all these chemicals. And so this is made from scratch, so why not?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I burned some sugar. Like, in the beginning, I didn't know how to make sweet vermouth either. So I prepared some sweet vermouth that I liked drinking, and then I picked all the things that I liked about those specific vermouths. And one of the things was burning sugar. Now, you guys are chefs and burn sugar all the time. I'm a bartender. I never burned sugar before in my life. So,
well, 2 days a day.
So there's a cool website. It's called Google. And so I went on there, and I'm like, how do you burn sugar? Well, it turned out to be quite easy. And then like I added some warm wine to it. Add some spices to it, what spices I liked, and then I added the spices that I use a lot. Please. So, technically speaking, when you're talking about vermouth, it's a fortified wine.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a white wine in it right now. And the main ingredient is wormwood. Super easy. Wormwood is translated to vermouth. It's a German word, actually. If you ever tried wormwood by itself, super bitter.
Very bitter.
Very bitter.
Not going to like that one.
I had no idea how bitter it was until I put too much in it. That was really easy. So, and I'm going to add some spices to it. I have some rosemary, I have some sage, I have sassafras, I added some peppercorns to open flavors as well. But there are a lot of traditional bittering agents. And I use a variety of bittering agents to make a rounder feel to it. Because mm-hmm. The wormwood is bitter, the sassafras has a bitterness to it, burdock root has a bitterness to it, but they all have different kinds of bitterness, and together they make a whole kind of idea.
So where do you buy wormwood in the spice shop?
Yep. Like, yeah, you can just go. There's one on the corner
I've
here.
I've never bought wormwood.
One of the cool things that I found as well is a black cardamom. Something most of you guys probably cook with green cardamom. It's the most common thing. The way they dry it out is on fire, and it gives a really smoky flavor. It has a little a minty flavor to it as well, and it really brings a broader, like a rounder flavor to the vermouth. I use a little port as well to it. And
boy, I would never have guessed that.
Right?
Yeah.
What's that
really?
For?
Is that typical for vermouth?
Well, so the recipe is a secret.
Oh.
Like,
you know,
like, no. But like if you go online and Google. sweet vermouth and recipes, you won't find any. Like Noli Pratt, Carpano Antica.
They won't give you the recipe.
They're all
sure.
secret. And they will not tell you what's in it. There's like hints of things that are possibly in there. But that's about it. And like when you taste it, you can think like, oh, this has a little porty flavor to it. Mm-hmm. That's why I added to it, because I made my sweet vermouth and not Carpano Antica.
And so when you think about porty flavor, you're thinking about a little bit maybe overripe fruit or
absolutely.
Aged fruit. Or
yeah, I got some extra ones as well with me. I got some prunes as well that I'm all going to add to it and warm it up. Yeah, and make a whole. Now, sweet vermouth, it is a fortified, so you do need to add some brandy to it. Technically speaking, you talk about a white brandy, and I thought, why not use pisco?
I just come from Peru.
Oh, a good time?
I had the best pisco of my life. That's fantastic.
I hope so.
I have developed a very good pisco.
It's got, like going to Seattle and not have good salmon, you know?
That's right.
But like the pisco actually adds flavor to it as well. That was the idea why I chose pisco and not just like a plain white brandy.
Right.
And I add everything together, let it sit overnight, and then I strain it and sweet vermouth.
So in Italy, you think they use grappa? Is that what you think?
No, I mean, like of course, that's a very good point. But like grappa in general is a little bit more pricey. So you try to find a balance, like, you know, price and the quality and .
But what about just drinking it on ice?
I also like that. Or I like to make an Americano with mm-hmm. a little Campari and soda.
So let's taste this concoction here if we could. And what should we be? Well, I know what I like in sweet vermouth, and I do like it in Manhattan. It's often too sweet for me, sweet vermouth, so I tend to drink the dry vermouth.
And I think this is what's so cool about this one.
Which is what, Chef?
It's not as sweet as I thought it was going to be. I like the bitter from the caramel and from the burnt sugar and from probably the wormwood and all that. Yeah. Then you put in there. It's really nice. So it's very nice.
But you know what? So when I wrote this book, the idea was to write the things that I like.
Right.
You know, and what I want you to do is like take this book and make the things
that
you like.
Own.
Yeah, like if you like it not less sweet, use less sugar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're a chef. Or like if you like it more bitter or less bitter, you know, this is all like flavor profiles you can play with. Maybe you like a little bit of freshness, add some lime or lemon peel to it. Or, mm-hmm. you know, it's really like a fun project, like when you play with recipes.
I can't wait to make that. You know what? I'm going to make some dry vermouth, some sweet vermouth.
As I'm tasting it, I'm certainly getting the caramelized sugar. That's a big component, it seems to me. Does it, when you used white wine, does it matter which one? Do you like a particular profile?
So ideally, they use the Moscato grapes. But like a dry, acidic white wine. That's
like Trebbiano or Pinot Gris.
Or like a Sauvignon Blanc.
Sauvignon Blanc.
Something
Muscadet, something really different.
Yeah, super easy to find.
Mm-hmm. And inexpensive, too. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. It's all about being inexpensive and making it delicious.
Now, if you want, you just have to make this over and over to get exactly where you want. But if I were to say to you, you know, I want it, I like this a lot, and I'm getting lots of flavors, but I want it just a little bit more bitter. Yeah. Where would you directly head on my next batch?
Well, it's super easy to make anything bitter. It's gentian root. Gentian root is the bittering agent in Campari,
uh-huh.
In bitters as well. And that's you need less than the wormwood. It's really, really bitter.
It's really bitter.
Yeah.
In France,
what about hops? Would hops get a bitter, or are they too fruity?
Yeah. Hops, that'd be totally cool. Oh. Yeah. No, like, I love, like, playing with, you know, like, use the hops and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm all about, it's all about failing.
Green almond. Like,
yeah. Because, like, otherwise, what do you learn?
The book is called Bar Chef, Handcrafted Cocktails. Christian Rolick has been our guest. It's super fun. I have never jumped into this arena,
cool.
Chef. I don't know about you, but
no, this is totally a new thing for me. I'm excited.
Thank you.
In your book, it's not just sweet vermouth, correct?
No, there's dry vermouth, cherry liqueur, orange liqueur, a whole variety of side ingredients that you make in cocktails or use in cocktails.
Sweet, sweet vermouth. How delicious are you? I don't know because I don't really drink vermouth. I'll drink anything else under the sun. But vermouth, get out of here. Coming up next on the Best of Seattle Kitchen, we've got, you know what? Tom's wife, Jackie's going to be making an appearance. She's the head farmer at Prosser Farms. And if you remember earlier in the show, I said there was one segment that has not yet aired on the radio, and that would be this one featuring Miss Jackie Cross. My name is Sean. This is the Best of the Seattle Kitchen. We'll be right back here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all. My favorite vegetable.
Beach Boys, a song called Vegetables, bringing us in here on the Best of the Seattle Kitchen. My name is Sean. You're listening to Cairo Radio. I don't know why you would not be listening to Cairo Radio. So coming up in this segment of Seattle Kitchen, Tom's lovely wife, Jackie, and she is lovely. I have met her before. She is the head farmer at Prosser Farms, and she's going to be dropping by here to talk all about crops.
What's happening at Prosser Farm? How are your dinners selling? And
dinners are selling well. They're all sold out for the season, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. That's where we like to be right now.
So don't tell us about it. No, I'm just kidding. What are they?
And then right now we're just busy transplanting. That's the big push right now in springtime. All the peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, melons, seeding beans. Picking lots of lettuces and robs and greens and stuff at the moment. So
remind us how it all got started. How did we get to this point where you're actually planting now plants? Because I know you didn't go to Swanson's and pick up tomato plants and pepper plants.
Darn it, I wish I had.
Yeah.
No. We have a couple small greenhouses at the farm, and usually mid-February we start seeding peppers in them, and then we baby them along, and tomatoes come after. It takes us probably a good couple months, 2 to 3 months, before they're big enough to transplant out. So we move them around in the greenhouse. Then when they get to be teenagers, they move outside into the hoop house, which is a little cooler and exposed to the elements a little bit when it's warm enough to pull up the sides. And it gives them enough strength and builds up their stem.
So it starts to harden the stem.
Starts to harden them off, and it gets them used to being outside in the temperatures. And once they spend about a month, 3 weeks to a month there, then they get transplanted into the ground, and you cross your fingers and hope for the best.
And it sounds so easy, but it's 6,000 pepper plants.
I know. It's
3,500 tomato plants.
I was going to say, it's not exactly like people think, you just plant. So you just pick the peppers when it's time to pick them. Well, you got to. Six months before you're going to stop.
You start a long way out, and then it takes a long time to choose which seeds you're going to plant and how many of them and how many rows you're going to dedicate to them. We work with the chefs on what they want, what they're looking for.
So that happened back in December.
That happened back in December, and that's when we purchase all of our seeds.
So here we are, the end of May, and we're already 6 months into the farm season.
Right.
And we haven't even, the peppers are starting to flower, but it's going to be a while before
Isn't
you see
Isn't that astonishing how much work it is?
No, of course. Well, farming is a 24-hour job.
It's
7 days a week and never stops because
It's year long, even though you think that everything is just July, August, September. But
yeah, because
it takes all
months,
year to make it happen.
You got to mulch the ground. You got to turn the ground. You got to do all this
stuff.
We
add a lot of amendments and stuff like that, pelleted chicken manure and compost, and till the grounds a couple times. We have a lot of green cover crops that we put in the fall and in the spring. So we let those mature and then turn those under to try and keep our soil as nutritious as possible.
Right. And we have 18 chickens, Terry, and you would think that would be enough manure for the 7 acres that Jackie actually tills out
we
there.
Don't
God,
use
they
our,
poop a
we
lot.
Don't use our own chicken manure.
I know you
it
don't.
It has to be heated to a certain degree to be able to be sterile enough. For
yeah,
it.
Exactly. But it does
That's
feel that way. Looking
I know.
So right now you're picking up green like lettuces, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of lettuces.
So when did you plant those?
When do we bring them?
No, when did you plant them?
When we planted those. We planted those about 7 weeks ago.
So just after the snow
starts going. Yeah, so it's cool, so it takes a little bit of time. Yes, just after the snow melted. We got in as much as we could because we want to turn that field over and plant tomatoes in it. So we tried to get as much greens out of there as we possibly could before we reset that and transplant tomatoes.
Cool.
Yeah, when you lose a little bit of lettuce to a frost or something like that, it's not like losing a four-month-old tomato plant.
No,
that you
exactly.
From seeds. Yeah, so.
Yeah. The amount of work is not quite as intense. Yeah. I mean, lettuce is...
We start those in the greenhouse also. We do seed those in the greenhouse and transplant. So
I always tell people, you know, a row of lettuce is... You plant one row of lettuce every 3 weeks. You have lettuce for four people for a whole year if you do it.
Yeah. On the west side.
Yeah.
On the east side, they tend to bolt.
Oh, yeah.
So,
it gets, when it warms up over there, sometimes it can warm up fast.
Yeah, that's
in
the problem
with
too much heat.
And,
yeah.
Sometimes it's too much for them. But we've had, which I'm thankful for, a cool spring so far, which has been great. You know, hopefully now it warms up. Now we've got peppers and tomatoes in. But it really helps the transplants when it's cool and a little bit dampish. It's great.
But didn't the governor just said we are in a drought already?
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
I was reading that a couple of days ago. I'm like, wait a minute. It's not even mid-May and we're in the drought. What happened there?
Not enough snowpack. I mean, all the snow came at one time, and it was a lot, but there wasn't enough spread out to feed the
Interesting.
Rivers.
And pretty much a dry. We've had a record dry spell in spring and some warmth that's already melted the snowpack, right?
Which last year it was too hot too early, and this year we have no water.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, it's funny that they say it's a drought. I mean, we had more snow than we've ever had over there, for sure.
At the farm,
at
but
the
not
farm,
up in the mountains.
But not up in the mountains.
Right, Interesting.
It's interesting how the weather giveth and the weather take it away.
Absolutely.
You know, last year we lost 1,000 lineal feet of sweet peas, right, to the sage rats, the little groundhogs. This year, they froze to death in that cold snap, and so we haven't had any sage rat
I know, I've
problems.
Only seen a couple of them, which is amazing. Last year there were hundreds of them.
So they actually
knock on wood.
They actually get decimated by the weather. That's pretty.
Yeah.
That's
well,
pretty
I think it was a combo.
Oh. So cold for so long.
Yeah.
And so much snowpack over the top of their burrows that they couldn't get out to get anything to eat. So
as we move forward now, what's your timetable through say June?
For what we pick, what
and
we're picking,
what you
and stuff like we'll have peas ready probably by the end of this week. Beginning of next week, we'll start picking peas. We'll have lettuces and greens that will continue to grow. We have a lot of mustard greens.
Herbs,
tons and tons of herbs. It'll be a little bit of lull in vegetables and stuff until everything sets and starts going. But cucumbers come on pretty quick. So
Strawberries. I'm desperate for local strawberries.
Yeah, me too.
I wish I had more strawberries over there, but the ones that we have have a lot on them. Mm-hmm. We'll start to see local cherries coming out of the area really soon. Which is great. We have a couple contacts with farmers over there, and we bring over their cherries and stuff for.
So one of the things I would encourage you when you go to your grocery store is do a little digging. Look at the asparagus. Don't just say grown in USA. Look for grown in Washington.
Yeah,
right?
Eastern Washington.
Same with cherries.
Rhubarb,
peas, you know,
lettuces.
Blueberries, all those different things.
Yeah. Well, the idea is, you know, we don't sell in that kind of marketplace, but try to support your local farmers and get out there and support Washington agriculture.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jack.
Lovely, Jackie. Thanks for all that helpful information about vegetables and Prosser Farm and how you do the thing that you do. Well, unfortunately, Seattle Kitchen is now over. We have concluded this session of the Best of Seattle Kitchen, but we'll be back next week with another surprise Best of the Seattle Kitchen. What's going on? I have no clue. Tom and Terry will be back at some point. Again, when you've got food and money at your disposal, gallivanting is really the only thing you can do. So, who knows? Maybe he's in Scotland playing some... Was that Irish or Scottish? I don't know. I've probably offended somebody, but what's new these days? This is not a therapy session, Sean. You are listening to the Best of the Seattle Kitchen. My name is Sean. This is Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.